Welcome to the Seniors with Vision Loss program today. We're going to have a program on in-home support services put together by Teddy Joy Rimhill. And my name is Vicki Parker, and I've been chairperson of this committee less than a year. And this is our second program that we have put together. Teddy did this one single-handedly, if that's a word. And I appreciate everything that she's done. We're hoping over the next few months to put together some phone calls to gain support for seniors and some other activities locally so that our committee can be more active and do more outreach for people who do not come to these conventions. So without further ado, Teddy Joy is going to introduce the program and the panel.
Okay, thank you, Vicki, and we're so happy to have Vicki taking over the chairmanship of this committee. It's been around since the middle 90s. Actually, I was the first chair of this committee back in 95, 96, and thought it was such a great idea then, and we're still here. What do you know? But anyway, so we have a panel today on in-home supportive services, and the reason I brought it up as a potential topic for this committee is that it's the program itself in the state of California is widely used throughout over 400,000 consumers of in-home supportive services in the state of California. And for the most part, they are people over the age of 65. And I want to tell you a little bit about the history of the program. Started back in the 19—well, our panel today is going to be Fran Smith is on my right. And she's the executive director of the public authority for Yolo County, which oversees the IHSS program in Yolo County. And on my left is Jeff Tom, who of course is our new president of CCB, and also been the chair of our governmental affairs and very knowledgeable about the IHSS litigation currently in process. And on my far left is Jane Cardis, who is a longtime CCB member and a resident of Ukiah, California, and a consumer of the IHSS program, so she can talk about it firsthand as a consumer. So anyway, what I wanted to tell you about the history of it was that back in the 90s, I worked for the public authority for L.A. County for 9 years, starting in the year 2000 when they were first established. And the public authority was established way before that up in Northern California. There were about five of them up here before L.A. was established. But they were established for the purpose of being the middleman between the county and the unions. And so they were called as the employer of record. So I went to work for them. And one of the main purposes for them was having the registry. Now, the way IHS works is that the state pays the salary of the worker, and you have to qualify on an income level to be eligible. But the consumer hires, fires, trains, or whatever the person that they want. And the reason that started back in the 1970s, it seems that in California, there were a lot of people institutionalized because of the polio epidemic. And the politicians, in their wisdom, which happens occasionally, the politicians in their wisdom saw that it was probably a financially sensible for people to be in those recovering situations to be cared for at home. It costs more to keep them in institutions. And so they started this process of something that resembled IHSS, and it evolved into that. And at the time of the independent living movement in Berkeley, of the disabled population, there was a gentleman at the university in Berkeley who, Ed Roberts, okay. Ed Roberts, they've built a center there in Oakland where it's now the Ed Roberts Pavilion. And he was He was a quadriplegic trying to go to the university, and he was rejected, and they wouldn't have him. He needed breathing equipment and so forth. Anyway, finally he fought the fight, and he got accepted, and he graduated, and eventually he became appointed. Interestingly enough, he was appointed to become director of the Department of Rehabilitation by our now Governor Jerry Brown back in those years. And anyway, the independent living movement that started when he was fighting for his rights to become a student at the university evolved into what we now know as independent living centers, but also the in-home supportive service program, where the people who had these very serious physical disabilities wanted to live independently in the community, wanted to be in charge of their lives, wanted not to be institutionalized, and wanted to have someone in the home. And the state found out this was more reasonably and economically feasible. So they started this program, I think, around 1973. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, 1973. And that's when at that time, the population was, for the most part, a very severely physically disabled population. And they were made up of a lot of these really feisty independent living advocates who fought for their right to be independent and to live in the home. So what we say about the program when I was going around doing outreach in the community was that this is a program that helps people to remain in the community, to live independently in their home, to be in charge of their lives, and to be to avoid institutionalization, and to have the respect of the community in achieving that. The demographics have evolved over the years. So that's 40 years since that started. So over the years, the population, and because we're an aging population, that's how the demographics are now changing. So when we get down to it, the 400,000 people that use the service in the state of California, and it is an income program, eligible program, so you have to be of a certain income. But they are now, for the most part, an older population, because that's what's happening to us demographically in our country today. We are an aging population. And so as we age, despite the fact that, in addition to the fact that we, as the community of people in the blind community, have that disability, that may not necessarily require in-home care. But as you age, other disabilities may evolve, may become more, make life more difficult. And that's when you have someone come in, and once you're declared eligible, to come in and say, this is what you need in order to stay in your home, this is how many hours you need, and so forth and so on. And Fran will go into that, because she's more familiar with the registry and how that works. So it's a program that really is beneficial to the population. But what we try to convince legislators of every time they try to cut this program and cut the budget on it, we try to convince them that it is more economically feasible to continue this program than to create more people to be institutionalized. The nursing homes are a lot more expensive, and they have you don't have the quality of life. So as long as you can stay in your home and get the care you need, that's when you get the quality of life that you need in order to be, to live a full life. And as long as you can, as long as now we are living longer. And you know, we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of the California Council of the Blind. And I've got 1 year on them. I'm 1 year older, so I'm I can speak for the aging population, although not in any great depth in terms of disability. But I have worked in the field, and I have worked with these people, the people that use the service, and I really really see the importance of it and the need for it, and the, really do a lot of legislative advocacy about it as the years have gone by. So anyway, I would like to go on now and introduce Fran Smith. I said she's the director of the Public Authority for Yolo County, and she's been in the program for years. I think I first met Fran when I started working with the Public Authority back in 2000. So Fran predates my my employment with it. But anyway, and Fran Smith.
Teddy's an inspiration, isn't she? 81 and still flying up and down the country and giving presentations. So my story is, I started out as the mother of a daughter with a lot of cerebral palsy, and a few years later a son with some cerebral palsy, and went through the education and therapy and surgery business. And as they became adults, they aged into, because they had a disability, they qualified for in-home support services, which, as Teddy said, was created in 1973. So Cheryl and Mike moved into their own apartments, and they had an in-home support service provider, and it was wonderful. I knew nothing about the formation of in-home support. All I knew is Cheryl and Mike had somebody that could come in and do their personal care and their domestic services. And when that person didn't show up, Mom became the substitute provider. And I had to deal with all the payroll issues in Alameda County, which were horrendous, and I don't know that payroll issues in Alameda County have gotten any better. In 1998, there was an ad in the an article in the Contra Costa Times that the county was interested in starting something called a public authority, and they wanted volunteers to be on the committee to design it. So I sent in my application, and I was selected. I had no idea what this was going to be. But there were a group of 40 of us who met twice a month for 8 months. And a man named Eldon Luce, I don't know any of you know Eldon Luce or not, he started the first public authority in San Mateo County. A person with some disability, he had been the director of the Independent Living Center in San Mateo County. And when first there was a permissive law, the state said, so in-home support is going for a few years, and it's funded. And people like my Cheryl and Mike had trouble finding providers. If they knew somebody they could hire, and the pay was minimum wage, if they knew somebody they could hire, that was fine. If they had a relative, if they went to a church, that was fine. But more and more, it became more and more difficult to find people, and particularly people who had had a background check, or had had any training, or had had any interview. So unions, SEIU, UDW, I don't think CU was around then, but the unions got together with those feisty people with physical disabilities who said there's got to be a better way to do this. And they did, yeah, they were feisty. By the way, I lived in Contra Costa County, but I did a lot of work with the BART Elderly and Handicapped Task Force and got acquainted with Ed Roberts in those days. So I was around when Ed was around. Michael's wheelchair, when it would break down, we would take it to CIL for wheelchair repairs. So I'm part of the family, if you want to think of me that way. So there were independent recipients, IHSS recipients, some providers, advocates, and labor, and the unions got together, and they talked to a couple of legislators, and a law was passed that said counties could, if they chose, they could set up this public authority. Because I'm a mom, and now I work for the outfit, I believe that the real purpose was to enhance the program for the consumers. That's what I thought. It took me a while to realize the union really wanted to bargain for wages, and they needed that go-between. They needed the go-between the county and the union, and public authorities were set up to be the employer of record. That's a legal term. It means we have the authority to negotiate wages. So public authorities, the first ones were San Mateo, San Francisco, I just lost it,
Alameda.
Those were the first three. They were the big three. and they proved themselves worthy. And so that group of advocates went back to the legislature and said, all right, we need a mandate. Every county needs to have one. And so another law was passed in 1999, AB 1682, and it mandated that every county have either a public authority or a nonprofit consortium. And there are now 54 public authorities throughout California. As I say, I was helping Cheryl and Mike when their attendance didn't show up, and when their paychecks for the providers didn't come. And so I kind of knew the problems. Then I was on this committee to design the public authority in Contra Costa, and Eldon took us every meeting. He took us through a binder full of pages. We had to consider policies, and then we made recommendations to the county. So I kind of figured this is going to be a good thing. This is something that we need, because there would be a registry, and the registry would recruit providers and would screen them and would have a face-to-face meeting with them and would check references for anybody who wanted to be on the registry. Now, mind you, there are already thousands of people working as in-home support service providers without background checks, without anything like that. So I thought, this thing is going to be good. We could help the consumers find somebody. We could give training to the providers, because that's one of our mandates. First mandate is employer of record. Second is operate a registry. Third is do background checks on providers. Fourth is make training available. Fifth is any other services that are needed, right? So one of the things in the law says, the law said in the beginning, was public authorities would run an emergency backup system. So if a provider didn't come to work, the public authorities would have a roster of people that they could send. It's sort of been implemented. We're one of the public authorities in Yolo County that still does a backup care system. So back to the mandate comes down at the same time there was a deficit in California, and IHS employees were being laid off because their budgets were cut. So our public authority sprang to life in the middle of a big deficit when social workers were being laid off. And I can tell you the county was not happy about us. Who were these people and what did they know? And the IHSS social workers did the assessment. They did the allocation of hours. They figured out what people's needs were. And I was told right away, IHSS is not a program to satisfy wants. It's a program to meet needs. So if the social worker says you need something, and the social worker knows that because they go to the house and observe you and assess you and watch you walk around and what you can do for yourself and what you can't do. So anyway, this public authority, our committee made our recommendations to the Board of Supervisors in Contra Costa. And the choices, we were divided. The room was, I told you, there were 40 people, and about half of them were county employees, and the other half were interested others, like somebody like me, somebody from the Independent Living Center in Contra Costa County, and I don't think we had anybody there from Disability Rights. Maybe Disability Rights hadn't got to that point yet. Anyway, so we came up with two recommendations. One is the public authority be freestanding, separate, nonprofit. That was one of the options in the law. The other was that it be an arm of the county. Couldn't be the county, because there has to be a firewall between the public authority and the county. So if any of the providers that we refer do some bad things in the homes of people who are vulnerable, that the county is protected from that liability. And so that's one of the sort of unrecognized functions of the public authority. We protect the county from liability. Okay, so we do all our recommendations. We go to the Board of Supervisors. The presentation is made by the chair of this design committee. And the Board of Supervisors, no surprise, said, we will choose the county option. And the public authority director will report to the director of aging and adult services. So Contra Costa County was the seventh county to set up a public authority. It was the last county before the law said there will be a mandate. So the mandate comes down, and good Eldon, and Eldon and his wife Kate and our family were family friends, and we spend weekends together. In fact, we're all planning to celebrate my 80th birthday this July in Monterey. So I said to Eldon, the next to the last meeting of our design team, you know, Eldon, this county is going to set this thing up, and they're probably going to choose you to be the director. And if they do, I want you to hire me. And he laughed, and he said, wouldn't that be fun? And I thought, boy, you just don't know. So the Board of Supervisors did choose the county option. They did hire Eldon. It took a year. And I read again in the paper that the public authority was looking for volunteers to be on the Consumer Advisory Committee. It was, and if you were interested in that, please contact Eldon Luce. So I picked up the phone and said, Eldon, it happened. And he said, oh, yes, and they hired me. And I said, good. I don't want to be on the advisory committee. I want to be on your staff. So that happened, too. It was the hardest interview I've ever been through in my life because two of the members of the design team and Eldon and somebody from the county were on the interview panel, and I was so nervous. I just thought, I've known what this public authority is supposed to do, and I know I can be the program manager. So it did happen that I did get hired. And 4 months after I started working, and Eldon handed me all these recommendations, and he said, okay, now implement these. So from the inside out now, I'm putting into work, setting up the job descriptions of the people, hiring the people, setting up the registry, making sure that the registry worked the way it said we were supposed to do it. The law comes down that every county in California has to have a public authority, and guess who every county wanted as their consultant to set up a public authority? Eldon Luce runs all over the state. He set up 20 of the public authorities from, I guess, Northern California. I forget. Riverside was probably the furthest south. So this is all by way of background. He was gone. I was there 8 years late. Well, at some point, Yolo County set up a public authority, and they were recruiting for a director, and the job description went out on the internet, and I looked at it and thought, I'm happy where I am. I was very happy in Contra Costa. We ended up with 4 registry specialists. They did the recruitment of the providers. They did the orientation. They set up the database with all the information in it. Then the consumers who couldn't find their own provider called us and said, can you help? And we did. We made home visits sometimes. If there were problems, we'd go out and negotiate. Not me, but the registry specialist would go to the homes and negotiate disputes. So from setting up the policies to implementing the policies and loving the job, I absolutely love the job. I didn't like the battles when time checks were late and it'd have to battle with payroll. What happened to it? What happened to their timesheets? Well, anyway, that's the part of the job I didn't like. So I'm there, and Eldon leaves, and they hire a new director, and I train the new director on how to run a public authority. And then he leaves, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture? I was pretty sure they weren't going to hire me. And one more time, this is about the third time, Yolo County wanted an executive director. And I have a friend, I don't know if any of you know Burns Vick. I think some of you might know Burns Vick. Well, Burns and I had been good friends when I was working in developmental services. And I called him up and I said, I'm thinking about sending my application to Yolo County. He said, oh my goodness, I know Mariko Yamada. Do any of you know Mariko Yamada? She's now chair of the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee for the Assembly. And at that time, she was a supervisor in Yolo County. So Burns and his partner and Eldon and Kate and my granddaughter and my great-grandson and I were in Virginia City at Christmas time for the Victorian Christmas, or in Nevada City for the Victorian Christmas. And Eldon says, come with me. And we walk down the hallway of this really old hotel, and he calls Mariko Yamada. Now, this is a Saturday morning in December, and he said, I've got the perfect director for Yolo County, and she's standing right here with me, and I've known her for years, and I want you to talk to her. So I'm talking on a cell phone in this dim, dingy hallway in this old hotel, and Mariko Yamada says, well, you sound interesting. Let's meet. So a week later, we met at Pete's Coffee Shop in Vacaville. She was campaigning then, running again. She was running for the assembly at that point. And we talked for an hour and a half. And she said, please send your application. I said, you know, I can't guarantee anything. You have to go through the regular process, but I'll do what I can to help you. So it came to pass that I left YOLO. I left Contra Costa with, trying to think how many thousand IHSS consumers. And I supervised 13 staff by then. And I go to YOLO County with something like 2,000 IHSS consumers and 1,800 providers and two payroll staff who get those timesheets in and get those paychecks out. And my job got a whole lot easier. I got paid a lot more money and I'm having a lot more fun. And I'm still in YOLO County. So I'm here to tell you that there are 54 public authorities around California. The largest is where Teddy's from, Los Angeles. Obviously, it has half the IHSS consumers in the whole state. And the smallest is probably, I want to think Amador County, Amador, El Dorado. They have something like 200 consumers. But we're all doing the same thing. Some of us do everything, including the backup care program. Some of us are, we've had budget cuts. You know we've had budget cuts. And Teddy referred to the legislators as cutting the budget. It's never been the legislators who cut the budget. It's always been the governor, starting with Arnold. And even our good friend Jerry Brown is still cutting the budget. But we're surviving. I will tell you there's an association of public authorities called the California Association of Public Authorities, otherwise known as CAPA. And we're part of the advocacy network that's fighting to preserve the program and preserve the funding and protect consumer choice. What I learned about IHSS, my daughter lived for a few years in nursing homes because her regional center said that was the most appropriate placement. She didn't like other people deciding what she would wear. She didn't like other people telling her what she was going to do that day. She didn't like other people fixing the food and saying, this is what you'll eat, and you can't leave here unless you sign out. And somewhere she had an independent streak. I don't know where she got that. When Cheryl and her husband moved into a totally accessible apartment in downtown Oakland, a HUD, new HUD facility in downtown Oakland, she had to have a live-in attendant because the manager of the HUD program in Oakland said, oh my God, she's too disabled. She can't live here. I called my friend Al Zonka, who at that time was the director of protection and advocacy, and said, Al, they're telling me Cheryl can't live in this place that's built for people with disabilities. What's your position on that? And he said, Fran, if you want me to go to a meeting, I'll come, but they're discriminating against her on the basis of her disability, and they can't do that. So I called the director of the Housing Authority in Oakland and said, do you realize you're discriminating against my daughter because of her disabilities? And I've already talked to an attorney. Oh, we don't want any attorneys involved in this. So Cheryl and her husband, whom she met in that nursing home, moved into that totally accessible apartment. Oh, I forgot the critical point. In the nursing home, Cheryl would have a little temperature, and she'd spike a fever, and she would dehydrate, and she would end up in the emergency room. Or she'd have a panic attack, and they wouldn't know what to do with her, so she'd end up in the emergency room. Cheryl had a lot of scoliosis, and her body was not straight, and nurses had never seen anybody in her physical condition when they went through nursing training. So I'd go to the hospital and show them how to position her in the bed, and how to feed her, and how to, you know. When Cheryl and Bob moved into their fully accessible HUD apartment with a live-in attendant, they had their own money. They went to the Safeway store and spent their own money for their own food, what they wanted to eat. They went where they wanted to go in downtown Oakland, the garden spot of the universe, in case you didn't know. Cheryl never went back to the emergency room again. So in-home support service, as far as I'm concerned, saved her life, and she lived another 4 happy years until she didn't live anymore. Michael had the same experience. I believe in-home support is a lifesaver. It's not a problem. It's not a budget problem. It's a budget solution. Thank you.
Boy, thank you. Thank you so much, Fran. I just wanted to add a little anecdote. The job that I came to occupy at the public authority in L.A. County, the scenario was similar to Fran's. I was in, I don't know, some of you may remember when I went to Washington, D.C. for 1 year, 1999, and I had a job with a what did they call them? The law firm, the public. What is disability rights? It's protection.
Protection.
Yeah. Okay. So I went to write for. I went to work for PNA membership, the NAPIS organization in Washington D.C., and I was living in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I went to the Maryland Council of the Blind convention, and I met some other members of the affiliate who were blind, and a couple by the name of David and Patty Orocho, and at that convention. And then later, and they were neighbors of mine in Silver Spring. Later, I came to find out that David had gone for an interview that L.A. County was going to develop a public authority, and he went for the interview. And it was a nationwide search for the executive director, and they hired David, and I knew him, and I was a friend of theirs, and they liked me. And I said, if you're going to start a public authority in L.A. County, I want to come home, and you got to hire me. And they did, and that's how that wonderful job started for me. So that was kind of funny. That was being at the right time, place at the right time. Boy, it really worked. Anyway. So we've done a lot of legislative work in and out of working for the public authority. And when I was with L.A. County, that was a freestanding, independent public authority. We had our own board of directors, and they didn't answer. What the county did there was they developed a trust fund, and we had a fund of money to spend. And so we operated. They operated pretty independently. And a little flamboyantly, I must add, but but nevertheless, it was an interesting new way of operating a public authority. And it is the largest, so that's it was a lot different from some of the others. Anyway, so we had to do a lot of litigation. We had to find out a lot about what was going on out there. And so for the rest of this, the litigation part, I want Jeff to talk about his experience with IHSS and the coalition.
Thank you. I'm going to stay seated here. I have had several different types of relationships with the IHSS program. It began in the late 70s when, as some of you may not know, I actually spent a year in Los Angeles, but I never failed to become a Northern California snob, because I'll always be that. And I actually worked, as a disabled rights attorney briefly. And in that job, one of the things we were doing at that time in the late 70s was litigating the issue of whether family members could provide care for their in-home supportive services recipient children. That's correct. Children and parents, etc. And they could not. And then after the litigation, they did change the law, and now it's an important component, as you've just heard. It's an important component of the program. I then, second part of my relationship, which lasted many, many, many years, was sort of as a neutral outsider who sort of got a look at the program from the perspective of an attorney who worked on legislation for every side, and sometimes it could get very contentious. Sometimes unions and the consumers were on the same side. Sometimes they weren't. Sometimes people wanted background checks, and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes the counties had different viewpoints. there were a lot of There's a lot of friction, but it's kind of interesting because we've heard, we've heard a lot about the beginnings of the public authority system, and interestingly enough, and surprisingly enough in many ways, it was a Republican legislator from San Mateo County that actually spearheaded the adoption of the first permissive laws in that area, which I helped to draft more years ago than I would like to think. I knew him as my parents' legislator, and it's kind of very interesting. You wouldn't have expected it because he was working with unions, and he was from a fairly conservative part of San Mateo County. But it you know, engendered the beginnings of a system which has worked really, really well. There have been other areas of contention. You know, criminal background checks became very contentious. There was a while under the program when a large percentage of providers were coming from the prison system. And boy, did that get some bad publicity, as you might imagine. There were even courses being taught in the prison system about how to become an IHSS provider. And we're not talking about, in large part, we're not talking about, you know, a person who was, you know, the sister or brother of someone who came out of prison for whatever, drugs perhaps. We could be talking about some hardened criminal who, you know, wanted, you know, couldn't get any other kind of a job and wanted a potential way of not only making some money, but maybe rifling some things on the side. And so the program has morphed in many directions. Before I go on to some of the current legislative issues that have popped up, I just want to say, I won't spend much time on it because we've discussed it several times here, but our bill, AB 1703, to place reader services within the in-home supportive services mix, one of our co-sponsors is the California Association of Public Authorities. And I have worked long before I ever became the lobbyist for this organization. I have worked in a professional relationship with the lobbyist for the Association of Public Authorities for many, many years, even before there was an Association of Public Authorities. I worked with her. So I've had sort of tenuous, I guess you could say, relationships with a variety of people. And now I've sort of evolved, you know, some different relationships because, you know, I'm a fellow advocate for this organization. But the big couple of big issues this year is, number one, there is a 7% cut in funding, which could go away, excuse me, if a fee on providers were to be implemented. I'm going to tell you about that in a second and why I don't think that's much of a possibility, but this is my own personal ramblings here. The states have, and it started not in an in-home supportive services context, but in-home supportive services is now largely funded through Medicaid dollars. And in Medicaid, for a long, long time now, there are various gimmicks whereby provider fees are collected. They started in California, for example, with fees on on intermediate care facilities and skilled nursing facilities. They'd collect these fees, then the feds would match that money, and then the money would go back into being used by these facilities. So about 5 years ago, when I was still my last year as an attorney for the legislature, they tried a unique to California approach, drafting a sales tax on the service of providing in-home supportive services so that they would be collecting the sales tax from the provider. They would match it with federal money. The provider would get their money back through this system. It was actually, I learned from my colleague who I worked on it with, I had lunch a few weeks ago, the first ever proposed sales tax on a service as opposed to a good in California. However, the feds didn't go for it. That was 5 years ago. So if they can come up with a fee that the feds will accept, they can cause this cut not to happen. I keep chiding my friends in the unions because I didn't think it would work at the time as when I was a professional in the field. still don't think they'll get it done, because I don't think the feds really are as accepting of these type of fees as they used to be. But that's just me. I'm just, you know, my own professional bias, that I have no inside knowledge on that. And they keep saying, "Oh, come on, you gotta think positive." So we'll see. But the most important thing is the 7% cut. The alternative would be for the governor and for the legislature to just flat out repeal this cut. And that's one of the things in this year's budget battle that is being negotiated, and we'll see what happens with that. The other thing is, and this is a real important issue, and it's a position, and we have, as an organization, taken a position on it, is that a couple of years ago, maybe about a year ago, the federal government finally decided that domestic workers, including those that work in public programs like IHSS, by the way, California's IHSS program was a pioneer. We led the country in this, and we really can be very proud of that. There's still no program as comprehensive as ours, and that's part of the problem, because it is fairly comprehensive. It costs money, and governors like to chop away at it. But we really are a leader in the field. So the federal government decided that domestic workers should get overtime, finally, after decades and decades. And, you know, there were, you know, people on both sides of this issue, because the problem with the overtime is that it's going to increase costs a lot. And the concern was, if you increase costs, that the state will do something. The state said it was going to do something, and indeed the governor did propose to do something. Basically, the governor can't deny overtime if you work it, but what the governor can do, if the legislature goes along with it, is limit providers to 40 hours a week. The way they do it, the way they would propose to do it, is if you work 1 hour over or whatever, the first time you'd get paid, and the second time you'd get paid, because literally they can't violate federal law and not pay you. But then after that, you get kicked off. You couldn't be a provider anymore for whatever period of time. And so, and that would be legal, I think. Some people have questioned whether that would be legal, but I think it would be. State can run its program the way it wants to, public program. And so it's the only rationale for this is to save money. There's no, you know, no one is saying this is a great system, and, you know, no one is saying it has all these benefits. It just saves money. It will cause people who have more than one provider or who have providers that work more than 40 hours per week untold difficulties. People will have to try and find other providers and you know, at the last minute. The state has said, well, we'll come up with a system of backup providers, but you just heard from Fran, you know, in most counties, they barely have a system that works like that anyway, and now all of a sudden they're going to implement one, you know, willy-nilly. I think, you know, talking to some of the folks out there, I think that, and having read some editorials by legislators, I think there's a pretty good chance the governor may not get his way on this, because usually there's, excuse me, usually there can be some rationale for taking an action, but in a year where, you know, money is not seen as a major problem this year, and what you're doing is only done to save some money, it can be difficult at a program like this that people in both parties like. It can be very difficult to get to generate support for a major cut like that. So it wouldn't surprise me if the governor does not get this proposal. And to get this proposal, the law has to be changed to limit provider hours. So it's not something the governor can do unilaterally. So we'll see what happens. That, along with our little bill, which, you know, we've been fighting to get this bill. This is the third time we've run it. How many of you in this room remember, I know Connie and Connie does, how many of you remember Isidro Urena, one of our old lobbyists? Well, I worked on this with Sid 20 years ago, and we couldn't get it done then. And it's definitely time. And I really have to say, the United Domestic Workers, with whom I'm working very closely and are our primary co-sponsor, other groups like the public authorities, Disability Rights California, NFB, we've had all sorts of support for this bill, and it has been a great collaboration. Now, will we be able to get it through our committees? I think so. Will we be able to get the governor to sign off on it? Eventually, we're going to have a meeting with the governor's office, and we'll see. But it's long past time. It's such a no-brainer for this program, and something that should have been there 40 years ago. So with that, I think I've pass it on back to Teddy, and hopefully there'll be time for questions later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. And a final panelist is Jane Cardis, and Jane Cardis has been with CCB for a long time. I think all of you probably know Jane. She served on our board of directors, and in Ukiah and Mendocino County, she's on the IHSS County Committee for that program. And so she's very active with her legislator, who has been Wes Chesbro. And Jane is a consumer of the service, and so she's going to tell us about her experience and how it has met her needs.
Let me grab it. Okay. Hope I'm not sharing your cold, cough, flu, et cetera. Well, it will be. Anyway, I attended the Orientation Center for the Blind. I think it was 1993. Teddy thinks it was 1994 when I got out, but I think it was 1993. And Al Gill was my counselor. And I did not want to go, and I couldn't imagine, even though I'm blind myself, what I'd have in common with a bunch of blind people. But that was a most wonderful experience and a life-changing one. Because I had lost my vision quite suddenly, and I didn't know what to do. My marriage had fallen apart due to that, so my daughter said, Mom, why don't you move up, not with me, but to Ukiah, where I live, and I did. And I was in sort of a cooperative living situation where there were three different people living in this house. And that was odd for me, you know. And, you know, I had just always been with my mother, then my husband, then my second husband, and on. So I had never really been alone. And so when I moved into this cooperative place, Dee Jossel, who's was my landlady, and she knew all about in-home supportive services. And so she told me that I could get in-home supportive services, and I was a little taken back. And it's very difficult to have somebody come in and help you with your personal grooming and everything and get used to that. But it becomes a real necessity, and you just have to trust a great deal. So I was connected then with in-home supportive services. The first person I had was a young man, and so I didn't have any really personal thing with him, but he was the son of my landlady. And I was there quite a few years, and then my daughter and son found a place in, you know, that I was living independently, truly, in a little cottage by myself, and I'm still in that little cottage many, many, many years later. And I do enjoy my independence ever so much. And I try to be as involved as I can, you know, with, as Teddy said, my Assemblyman Wes Chesbro, who unfortunately is not going to run again. And, you know, and Mike Thompson before that, who was my, head fellow in Washington, D.C., And it is very important to participate in your own choices in your own life and to be able to live independently and in a situation where you have a sense of that. And I always have had that. It's difficult at the beginning and very difficult for a first-timer to have a stranger come into their home and deal with things. So, you know, it's the trust factor. And I've been very, very fortunate with everyone I've had. I haven't had any misdeeds. I know that there are quite a few people who have, but not me. And I feel very blessed that I can live safely in an environment, and I can be proactive in my community and feel like I'm giving back to a certain extent, and able to share my own personal situations and share with others to encourage them, you know, if at all possible, to maintain their independence and to be involved in community, because that promotes a feeling of well-being when you feel like you can give back something and not just be on the receptive side. But I, you know, I encourage anybody who does need it to investigate it. It is income-based to begin with. If you have Boku bucks, I think they feel like you can hire your own aide. But if you don't, then you can get in touch with your own in-home supportive service in your area, wherever that might be, and they would interview you, come out to your home, see what your special needs might be, what type of service you need. I have a gal now who's the most wonderful cook and very, very nice. You know, everybody, I've had a lot of different people over the years, and they've all brought something different to the plate. You know, so one of them likes to do one thing. It's very good. They've just all been wonderful, and they're all remaining friends with me, even as they move on, with the exception of one who passed away year before last with cancer. But it's a, you know, it's a great opportunity for us to be seniors, and like the other lady says, everybody in their 80s, I will be 80 on February 6th. So I'm running right after them. I'm right behind them. And yeah, I'm here now, and I'm enjoying the time that I have here. And thank you so much for listening to me. And if you have any questions at all, please don't hesitate to ask.
We have a wonderful volunteer. Can you hear me? Am I through the mic? I have what Jeff has, I think. And well, I didn't get it from Jeff. So I can't really hear what's happening. But we have a wonderful volunteer, Manny, who will run the mic for us. And so if you have any questions, I'm going to start off with a question. And then I'm a marriage and family therapist. I have my own practice, and I work for the Center for the Partially Sighted in the Tarzana office in Los Angeles. And I've seen many clients. So I would like to know just some general criteria, because I know there is a financial restriction, and I'd like to know if there are other restrictions. And can you tell me a little bit about where that cutoff, the financial restriction, is? Because I don't like referring people and then finding out that they don't get the services. They get very disappointed.
I'm not a social worker, but I certainly work in the program. The income eligibility for a single person, I think, is $800 a month, and for a married couple, it's like $1,200 or $1,300 a month to qualify for the eligibility. Then there's a level of need. What can you do for yourself? What you can't do for yourself? And so that assessment determines in, I don't know, something like 16 domains, like feeding yourself, bathing yourself for the personal care, domestic, can you do your own laundry, meal prep, cleaning, shopping. See, you all know the program better than I do. But if you're over that income eligibility, you can still get in-home support, but you would pay a share of cost. And sometimes the share of cost is more than it's worth to you. Do you know what I'm saying? My mother, when she was 90, my mother lived to be 97. And when she was 94, she was still living on her own in her own apartment, but needed some help. And I was at the house when the lady came to interview her. And she said, Goldie, can you do your own laundry? Oh, yeah, I can do my own laundry. Well, she couldn't, you know, she couldn't take the laundry down and move it from one machine to the other, but she wanted to think she could. Goldie, how about showers? Oh, I can take care of myself. And, you know, she went from her, she'd have to go from her wheelchair to the stool in the tub and have a handheld shower, which she had all of that, but at 94, you know, one little slip is, I just thought she was in danger. So people have, when they go for the assessment, the social worker, oh boy, I don't want to be quoted on this. Maybe I better be careful. When the program first started, it was an aggressive program, wanted to help people, wanted to get people the help they needed. As budgets got tighter and tighter, the guidelines became more and more restrictive. I sit across the hall now in Yolo County from social workers, and I think some of them think they're the guideline police, and they want to be sure that people aren't frauding the state. Well, I would like to see the glass half full, not empty. So this is my own internal struggle that I go through, but there is a set of guidelines that the state put out for consistency. We all thought it's for rationing, but no, the state said, no, this is for consistency. And I can understand if one social worker gives a lot of hours and the one next door doesn't give any, that's not fair. So there are guidelines. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, Vicki, but okay. If we have time sometime towards the end, I'd like to talk about all the reasons why the governor's work around paying overtime is bad.
Well, I'll say what Vicki might not have wanted to say. I tell people when I was working for the public authority, when you have an interview with a social worker, and it was the same for me when I wanted to get paratransit in my county, yes. The eligibility. Don't talk about what you can do. Talk about what you can't do.
On your worst day.
That's what I would tell consumers going to the IHSS interview. What you can't do on your worst day. Absolutely so.
This is Connie Gill. I had a lot of problems back in the 70s when my son was about 7 years old, and I tried to get, and the lady says, oh, your son can clean your house. And I've recently known a provider who, what gets me is these people are given all these hours, but they don't work that many hours. Yeah, and how do you, as a recipient of it, how can you make sure they do it?
Well, I mean, first, you know, the first thing you really need to do, and this, of course, can be tricky, but you really need to monitor your timesheets. And, you know, this has been part of the problem, we've tried to get them, you know, electronically so that we can look at them electronically. If you technically your provider isn't supposed to read them to you anyway, but realistically you want somebody other than your provider to look at them once in a while if you think there's a concern. If you don't think there's a concern, then the provider reading them is just fine. But if you do, you need to, because you do have to sign them. So it's your responsibility. That's part of this program's beginnings, underpinnings, is that it is the responsibility of the consumer to ensure that he or she runs the program effectively with his or her provider. So you need to, and whoever, to... Okay.
I'll come back to you, Jane. The public authorities, if they were established by Eldon Luce, have a set of policies for removing providers from the registry for minor offenses or major offenses. Two minor offenses in a year or one major will kick you off the registry. Doesn't mean you can't work for somebody anymore. It means we won't refer you. But not doing the assigned tasks, not completing the assigned hours, is a minor offense. One complaint, okay, we'll talk to you. Two complaints, too bad. We've told you the first time. If you do it again, you're off. Falsifying a timesheet is a major offense. And so from the public authority's perspective, we can remove you from the registry. What you guys do if you hire your own, you can turn the, every county has a fraud investigative unit. If they threaten not to come back, it might not be a bad thing. You know what I'm saying? You don't want somebody that you can't trust. And that's one of the reasons public authorities were established, was to find people that you... We put them through a lot of hoops, and we explain the program to them, and if they violate those things, then we can take them off and find somebody else for you. Now, Jane wants it back.
Okay, well, I think it, if you have somebody who consistently comes at a particular time and leaves at a particular time, I don't see, and that I don't know how anybody else does it, but that's the way that I do it. And if by any chance my person has a doctor's appointment or something, you know, we add it on or make it up. We don't just let it go by. And I think, Connie, I don't know if you have a consistent worker and a consistent schedule, but of course, you know, like me, I could not see what I am signing, but my worker has so many hours, and I utilize those hours, and I know other people who I've heard who are also sight impaired, friends of mine, who have had people ask them to sign a card, and they'll say, "Will you read that back to me?" Well, no, you weren't here that day. But I don't, I have not had that problem. And I do believe it, of course, it's up to the recipient to keep track of how many hours somebody's there. And I think, Connie, if it's consistent and your hours are consistent, it, if I don't see, well, I don't. You know, I don't see, no. But it is very difficult, and you do have to have trust. And you can sit down with your worker and say, how many hours did you put on here? And if you need to keep yourself a little tape recorder or something and record the day perhaps they didn't come or they came very late, something to that effect. But part of that responsibility does have to lie with the recipient, because you are the person who knows. But it's, and there is a lot of trust issues, because my recipient, I use a signature stamp. And so she needs to come in and use it, and we go over that before she sends in her time card. And she is paid twice a month. And sometimes in some counties, it is different. As far as, I think it's in San Francisco, they get paid quite a bit more. Living expenses, of course, are higher there. But I think we're around $10 an hour. And, you know, and as I said, depending on where you live, it might be a little bit higher. But, you know, I'll talk to you at lunch, Connie. And, you know, and we can talk some more about this. Thanks.
Madam Chair, this is Pam Paul G from the San Gabriel Valley Chapter. And this is off that topic, if that's all right, but it is a question that I've had for a long time. My understanding is that, because I'm not a recipient of, a receiver in home services, my understanding is it's based on persons who receive Medi-Cal. And I've always wondered, and if I have the wrong point of view, you guys can let me know, but I've always wondered why it is who persons who have worked for, such as myself, for 33 years and am now on SSDI aren't entitled to the same kind of service when we've worked all those years and paid in, and it just seems unjust to me. Thank you very much.
Because in-home supportive services, as we've said, is an income-based program linked initially very closely with SSI. Subsequently, its linkings have been removed to some degree, but there's still a very close link between the number of SSI recipients and the number of IHSS recipients. For those of us who have been working and have additional resources, we don't meet those income thresholds.
Oh, well, I don't know what to tell you.
Who can say? Maybe they're doing a better job of hiding their resources than you are. I don't know.
They know how to play the game.
Yeah. Yeah, that you cannot account for.
Okay, am I next? Hi, this is Josie Conkling, and I wanted to share that I've been on the program for just a short... Okay, am I on now?
No, you are.
Okay, I got in the service about 4 years ago when I retired, and let me tell you, I am very grateful that I have it. And I've actually trained the girl that's working with me because I'm her first blind person to help. And I keep track of her hours, and for example, the other day when she brought me to the convention, that took care of Friday. She couldn't come Friday, so we did it Thursday. She brought me here. We did a few things at home before we got here, and Sherry was very, very good. And I'm, you know, you got to be good to these guys that work for us. Let me tell you, they are very, the girl that works for me just does a lot of stuff I have her do. I always have an agenda. When she comes in the door, I know what she's going to do that day, and that's what you have to do. And right now I'm getting 9 hours a week, and I'm glad that I'm doing that I'm able to get that service. And the thing is with in-home support, I mean the reader service, I'm glad that's going to come through because she does a lot of that for me, whether it's my bills, whether it's a form I got to redo for my SMUD or for my you know whatever, and she reads my mail when she comes in every day, it's on the counter and I just have her do it. And she also helps me with my food list and also to label items that I buy at the store because I want boxes and some cans labeled. And she's able to do it. And I'm very, grateful for that. Okay?
Yeah, there's one of the things that we've had testimony, by the way, from the United Domestic Workers Lobbyist is the fact, and it's very, very true, that so many providers do provide things like reading and things like that gratis. They're not getting paid for, you know, those hours. And so, you know, for every bad provider, and they're out there, there's a lot of great ones.
This is Roger Peterson. I think that one of the interesting things that's going on here, on the list, on our list, we've been arguing about IHSS and whether blind people need it. And, you know, what's happened is that IHSS started, as Fran said, about with the ILC crowd, severely physically disabled people. And blind folks have a kind of a different culture about not needing help. By God, I'm going to do it myself. All I have to do is go to OCB and then I'll be able to read, you know. In a way, it's I've often said that we're still kind of in the, you know, in the civil rights movement, the racial civil rights movement. There was a period when that pride thing and that self-sufficiency thing was what I call the Booker T. Washington era, where, the Tuskegee guys, you know, could do everything. And you had to be, he said, you had to be better than white folks in order to expect to, you know. So, but anyway, we're learning, I said recently to somebody at ILC, I'm on an ILC board of directors, by the way, that I thought it was funny that we're going to get, it looked like we were going to get readers from medical sources and so forth. I said, is that a medical service? You know, but uh, uh, I I think that we have to, you know, that the whole thing about how blind people are viewed by society and how blind people view themselves is different from some of the other things. It's more like the Fran's mother, I can do it myself, you know, I can do the laundry, and in denial kind of thing. So I'm hoping we can all kind of come together a little bit on this. One question I wanted to ask, you guys are talking about income, about it being income related. To what extent are resources taken into consideration? If you have some money in the bank, you know, nowadays you don't get a pension anymore. You got to have an IRA.
Well, you're
that's
limited.
Money in the bank.
Yeah, you are limited to it. It's just the same as with SSI. You're limited to a certain amount of money in the bank. You can have your home. Is that right? Yeah, you can have your home, and you can have a certain amount of cash on hand. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I just want to make one comment about this community of blind people and the culture and all of that. I came into it a little later in my life than some of you. But, you know, I think that it does not relieve this culture of the all-American cultural valued valued way of living, which is rowing up the river of denial. You know, I think that everybody in this country is in denial of age, and age is going to cause more disabilities unless you die. If you die, then fine. You know, then you're eliminated. But if you keep getting older and older, you're going to have some other disability besides blindness. So let's, like, get a grip on aging around here, you know? It's a happening thing.
And thank God we're still here, right?
I wanted to speak to the lady who said, I've paid my taxes all these years, and as long as we're taking public money, the public wants to know it's being spent wisely. I think assisting people to live safely and independently in their homes is wise use of anybody's money. You've heard me say I'm almost 80 years old. You've heard me say I had two kids who went through the developmental services thing. I worked at the national level for United Cerebral Palsy in D.C., and Senator John Chafee, God rest him in peace, tried for 6 congressional sessions to revise the Medicaid rules. So Medicaid dollars, which were started by Lyndon Johnson to pay hospital bills for people who couldn't afford it, parents of kids in institutions said, our kids are in a hospital, we want Medicaid dollars to go to the institutions, and so they did. Now, we know that institutional living is way more expensive than community living. John Chafee went around the country looking at institutions and said, these are not good. They may not all be bad, but they're not good. People could live in their own homes in the community with the right support, or group homes in the community with the right supports. Let's change Medicaid dollars to go to the community. He never could get it through Congress or our U.S. Senate. So we've done waivers. We've siphoned Medicaid dollars to the community on a piece-by-piece basis. What I would like to see is all the money for institutions, nursing homes, and community to be one pot of money, and people could draw down from it for whatever they needed, wherever they needed it. I think there would be plenty of money. What we need to do is accept that public authorities are here, we're doing a good service for people who need it, and people who have paid taxes for many, many years need the same kind of services when they need help to stay in their own homes. I've been fighting for 4 years to get our public authority to be able to serve private pay people. You've heard me say Yolo County. Davis is Yolo County. There are people in Davis with sufficient incomes to pay, but they can't find providers who've been screened and had background checks and had training. So I'm with you, ma'am. And if you know Frances Grace Child from Sacramento, she's chair of my advisory committee, and she does that speech every single meeting. People who pay taxes to support poor people in their own homes deserve the same kind of support in their homes. The argument has been put forward by people long before I got on the scene, that Olmsted said it's a civil right to live in the community, and money for putting you in institution, not enough money to support you in the community, is a violation of your civil rights. I think as we limit the support that we give to people to stay in the community and push people into institutions, we're certainly violating their civil rights.
Can we give our panel a big hand? They did an excellent presentation. You guys, thank you so much. You did an excellent job. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I know CCLV is going to have their program. Bernice, do you want to say something about that program?
Sure. Oh, thank you very much. Vicki, a good program.